From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I've had death threats. I've had death threats, and they always say I've had threatening telephone calls to the house. It's fairly difficult to describe any contact at all with the RUC. The hatred's absolutely palpable. It's frightening. I mean, this is a frightening organisation. And this isn't particular to me. This is particular to any defence lawyer who touches this type of work.
Rosemary Nelson, in her own words, as the Irish human rights lawyer is buried near her home in Northern Ireland, will bring you an exclusive interview done with Nelson last year. Also, 17 colleges and universities join a White House anti-sweatshop association. We'll get response from students and the Land Bank of Brazil. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A man was shot dead in a Protestant area of Belfast, Northern Ireland's capital, on Wednesday, according to the BBC. The province has been tense since Protestant dissidents opposed to the deal killed a well-known Catholic human rights lawyer, Rosemary Nelson, in a booby-trap car bomb explosion near her home in the town of Lurgan on Monday. There was no indication whether Wednesday's incident was linked to a 30-year-old sectarian guerrilla conflict over the future of British rule over Northern Ireland. Two opposing Northern Ireland politicians meet today in the United States after being told they hold the lives of many of their countrymen in their hands. Former Senator George Mitchell sent the message to Protestant leader David Tremble and Sinn Féin's Gerry Adams as Mitchell was honored at the White House last night for his peace efforts in Northern Ireland. Today, Adams and Tremble will be discussing whether they can soon start working together in the same government. Ecuador's government reached a deal with the opposition-dominated Congress yesterday to tackle its worst financial crisis in decades and end more than a week of violent anti-government strikes and protests. Announcing the agreement at a news conference, President Jamil Mahuad said the new fiscal package to finance a gaping budget deficit allowed him to lift a national state of emergency and sharply reduce fuel prices, which were hiked nearly threefold last week. Meanwhile, taxi and bus drivers continue a three-day strike to protest a gasoline price increase, barricading streets and blocking traffic, but police and soldiers cleared some roadblocks, reducing the paralysis in the capital, Quito. Yesterday, the White House threatened to veto an aid package for hurricane-hit Central America and for Jordan over a provision barring the federal government from taking a share of the settlement state administrations reached with tobacco companies. The White House also objected to a Republican plan to pay for the $1.9 billion spending package by cutting back on aid to poor families, environmental initiatives, and funding for anti-terrorism programs. As requested by President Clinton, the Senate bill would free up $977 million to help Central American and Caribbean nations battered last year by Hurricanes Mitch and George. The money would help rebuild roads and bridges and would provide debt relief. Yesterday, U.S. senators sharply criticized Clinton administration policies that let Iraq sell oil while the United States bombs the country to contain its weapons capability. Senators from both parties in a joint meeting of the Foreign Relations and Energy panels questioned what they called a contradiction in U.S. policy, bombing campaigns to force Baghdad to comply with arms inspections on one hand, and on the other hand, U.S. support for raising the amounts of oil Iraq can export under the UN Oil for Food Relief Program. And defending administration policy, Energy Secretary Bill Richardson and Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Tom Pickering denied that U.S. support for lifting the amount of oil Iraq can pump under the UN Oil Program hurts domestic producers or helps Saddam Hussein. The Senate yesterday overwhelmingly agreed to make it national policy to deploy a national missile defense system as soon as technology permits, heeding warnings of a growing vulnerability to attack. The bill, approved 97-3, would commit the United States to put in place a defense system against limited missile attack, but does not specify a time frame, costs, or system specifics. Democrats Richard Durbin, Patrick Leahy, and Paul Wellstone were in dissent. They were the three who opposed the bill. Sudan has denied allegations of an institutionalized slave trade in the African country, but said tribal kidnappings are a common feature of its civil war. State television reported late yesterday that Sudan was responding to a report by the United Nations Children's Protection Agency, known as UNICEF, on slavery in the Sudan. It quoted Hassan Abdin, a foreign ministry undersecretary, as saying the Sudanese government is astonished by what appears in the statement by an internationally recognized organization fully acquainted with the situation in Sudan. Sudan has said that the Dinka tribe of mainly Christian southern Sudan and the Bagra tribe of the mainly Muslim north abduct each other's children and sometimes enslave them. Two Indonesian soldiers abducted in East Timor 2 weeks ago have been found dead. Military officials said the soldiers were tortured to death by youths belonging to the pro-independence National Council for the Timorese Resistance Group headed by detained rebel leader Xanana Gusmao. No further evidence was available.
People hurting each other, saying things that they regret.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Northern Ireland's predominantly Protestant police force faces allegations that it rejected a request to protect human rights lawyer Rosemary Nelson, who was killed on Sunday by a car bomb outside her home in Lurgan, 30 miles away from Belfast. Nelson had represented a number of defendants accused of belonging to the Irish Republican Army. The Red Hand Defenders, an anti-Catholic group, has claimed responsibility for the killing. Representatives of Sinn Féin yesterday accused Northern Ireland's police, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, known as the RUC, of culpability in Nelson's death, saying the force had refused to provide security for Nelson's protection. Protesters who took to the streets in the hours after the murder also accused the police force of complicity in the murder. The RUC flatly denied that any application for protection had ever been made on Nelson's behalf. These charges came as Northern Ireland's police chief, Sir Ronnie Flanagan, announced the British police would head the investigation into Nelson's killing, and he also requested help from the FBI. Today, Rosemary Nelson is being buried. There is a funeral for her in Northern Ireland. And on this day, we decided to play you an interview that Pacifica station WBAI did with her last April. It was part of the program Radio Free Erin, which is a weekly Irish program on WBAI that is run by John McDonough and his collective. This is Rosemary Nelson.
I might enlist her at the invitation of the Irish American Labour Coalition, and I'm very indebted to them for giving us this opportunity to highlight lawyer intimidation in the six counties over here, because the United Nations recently published a report which has been presented and deals solely with lawyer intimidation and the difficulties faced by people defending people of certain political persuasions within the six counties.
What type of intimidation are you talking about? Is it from the state itself?
It's from the RUC. It's from members of the RUC. It's not a new problem. It's a problem that has been going on for a long time. It was there prior to Pat Finucane's death and has gone on subsequent to his death. It can vary from physical assault to death threats. Now, death threats are fairly regular. They're relayed regularly to you through clients. And in fact, I was physically assaulted by the RUC and called a fingernaver on the Garvahy Road last year when the police lines moved in.
Right. Maybe explain to our audience, who exactly was Pat Finucane?
Pat Finucane was a lawyer who defended quite a few high-profile Republican cases, quite a few high-profile Republican clients. Pat Finucane was shot dead. In any other jurisdiction in the world that calls itself a democracy, the killing of a lawyer for defending clients would have been attacked, would have been questioned, would have been investigated. But simply because of the allegations of collusion, which were raised at the time and continue to be raised, the British government didn't want to address this. The RUC obviously didn't want to address it. So Pat Finucane died. He was simply shot dead for defending people with whose views the RUC didn't agree.
What has been your personal experience with threats from the RUC?
I've had death threats. I've had death threats from the RUC. I've had threatening telephone calls to the house. It's fairly difficult to describe any contact at all with the RUC. The hatred's absolutely palpable. It's frightening. I mean, this is a frightening organisation. And this isn't particular to me. This is particular to any defence lawyer who touches this type of work.
But I understand that there are relatively, perhaps because of this intimidation, there are relatively few defence lawyers who are willing to touch this
Absolutely.
Kind of work.
Absolutely, yes. I think the number of defence lawyers who touch this type of work are restricted to something like 30, 40. And in that context, in fact, 33 lawyers within the past 2 or 3 months issued a media statement basically calling for disbandment of the RUC and pointing out that there's a crisis of confidence in the rule of law in the six counties. People cannot and will not rely on getting justice while the RUC is the RUC and remains unreformed.
Why is there seems to be such an interest in the Finucane case right now?
Well, the interest in the Finucane case has just recently resurfaced. It appears that new evidence has emerged as to the role of Brian Nelson and British intelligence handlers in this. Now, this case was addressed specifically in the UN report, and you're right, it's a case that's gone on for far, far too long. It hasn't been looked at. And the response of the British government to the report has been totally inadequate. The British government said that the matter's been investigated twice and won't be investigated again. The fact is, the matter was investigated twice by the RUC, and it's against the RUC that these allegations of collusion are made. We need openness and impartiality.
Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about these revelations about Brian Nelson and his role in the assassination of Pat Finucane.
Yes, certainly. Brian Nelson was a UDA man. Brian Nelson, in fact, was a British agent who infiltrated the UDA. He eventually was charged with a number of very, very serious charges, including murder. It emerged that during the time the British intelligence services were handling Brian Nelson, he had indicated to these people that Pat Finucane was actively being targeted and was going to be shot. Pat Finucane wasn't warned. The RUC didn't warn him. British intelligence didn't warn him. Therefore, he died. He was shot dead. Now, as I said, Brian Nelson was charged with fairly, very serious charges. It appeared that he actively took part in some of these terrible acts. He made a statement, apparently he made a statement of some 800 pages, admitting his involvement and admitting the involvement of British intelligence services in a lot of terrorist incidents in the six counties. That case never came to trial because the Attorney General who prosecuted, who at the time incidentally was Sir Patrick Mayhew, who briefed Brian Kerr, who's now Mr Justice Brian Kerr, as his counsel, withdrew several of the most serious of those charges, including murder charges. And in fact, the court was told at the time that those charges were withdrawn, and this is a quote, after a rigorous examination of the interests of justice. Whose justice? Certainly not Pat Finucane's.
Maybe we can describe how this climate is created with the loyalists, the certain things they drop to loyalist prisoners, the RUC. You can speak about that MP getting up in the House of Commons,
yeah.
How they create an atmosphere where your life is in danger. What do the RUC say where they can really back off and say, listen, we had nothing to do with this, but I understand through interrogations of loyalist prisoners, they drop maybe your name or Pat Finucane's name.
Yes, well, I mean, they do that when they're interrogating loyalist prisoners. They'll say things like, I don't know why you don't shoot those Republican solicitors you have. I don't know why they can be allowed to live. I don't know why they die. I mean, clients of mine are arrested on fairly routine matters and they're told, don't request Nelson. She won't be about much longer. She's going to be shot. Now, if they say that long enough and they get somebody suggestible enough, who's to say what's going to happen? It's a dangerous practice. It worked. Pat Finucane died. And quite a few very competent, very able lawyers simply don't touch this type of work because they're afraid. Because it can seriously endanger your health.
Also with us in the studio is Jean Forrest. She's with U.S. Voice of Human Rights in Northern Ireland. Yes, Jean, who are we defending now?
Rosemary, the U.N. report is something like 32 pages long, but could you give us some of the highlights, what they're bringing out? Naturally, the British have officially rejected the tone of the report. I picked that up on the Internet last night. Could you give us a summary of some of the highlights of that report?
Yes, indeed. The United Nations report found quite categorically that there's routine, systematic, and concerted intimidation of defence lawyers within the six-county jurisdiction as a result of the type of work they do. It called for an open investigation into allegations of intimidation against defence lawyers, and incidentally, when this happens, who do we report it to? The RUC. The RUC finds itself invariably innocent in cases like this. And it's called for an open, impartial and independent investigation into the death of Pat Finucane. Now, I think after a rigorous examination of the interests of justice, this case demands openness.
I want to get to one of the other things you do. You represent some of the community where the Orangemen are marching through the Gavahi Road.
That's right.
And I remember last year, you were in negotiations with the British government, I believe, maybe even Mo Molan, up until like 2 in the morning when it was later found out they were just having you there and just leading you on. Why would anybody want to negotiate now with the British government, especially after what they did to you last year? Because I believe I read somewhere you were up to 2 or 3 in the morning the day before the march having legitimate negotiations about what to do. And meanwhile, they brought in all the British troops and forced the Orangemen through. I mean, is it possible to go back this year and do the same negotiations?
Well, what actually happened last year was I represent the coalition, the Gavahi Road Residents Coalition. These people sought to act within the law. These people had me there so that I could challenge a decision in a court of law. I remained there for that. In the event, no decision was made, no decision was notified. These people were denied access to the courts for a change. Now, whether or not that will happen this year is totally out of my hands. It's up to the Residents Coalition. But I can't say that that's a community that has suffered and suffered greatly. Now, I was downtown today at a Martin Luther King Memorial Rally, and I saw some great posters there, actually, which I mean to bring back, which say, I am somebody. That's what these people need to believe, that they are somebody. So far, they've been told they're not. And I sincerely hope that'll change this year.
Rosemary, we had on the sister, I believe it was on St. Patrick's Day, with Jean, the sister of Robert Hamill, a case that you have had the misfortune, I'd say, of handling.
Yeah.
A young man who was kicked to death on the streets of his hometown simply for being a Catholic. Mm-hmm. And the RUC was involved in that case as well, I believe. Can you tell us about that?
I can. That case is absolutely horrific. It's appalling. And it's something that should not take place in any democracy under any circumstances. This, again, was coming up to the marching season in Portadown. Nobody can underestimate the atmosphere in Portadown coming up to this march. Robert Hamill was returning home with a few friends after a night out. A loyalist crowd began to gather. Somebody who was walking down in front of Robert Hamill and his crowd, a Catholic, approached police in a Land Rover who were parked some yards from where the crowd had gathered. Warned the policemen that Robert Hamill and his friends were coming down and may need protection because of the extent of the hostility. Robert Hamill and his friends saw the van, felt safe because there were policemen, and walked down the street. They were attacked by the loyalist mob. Robert Hamill died, and the RUC didn't even open the door of the Land Rover to see what had happened. Robert Hamill died within full view and within yards of an RUC Land Rover.
I want
to
say
what,
that
if anything, has happened to the RUC men who sat in the van while he was kicked to death?
Well, this is all very interesting because, I've obviously, as legal representative for the family, been writing to the Secretary of State. I've written to the RUC. I've written everywhere. I can't get any official identification as to who these people were. They won't even tell me who they are. But I do know that they're not suspended from duty. I do know that they're still actively serving within the RUC. And they'll not give any answers. They'll not tell us why it happened. Robert Hamill, it appears, was dispensable. He was just another life.
Rosemary, I want to get back to you. You're describing all the death threats you're getting, the RUC cursing at you in the streets. What do you do for your own protection?
Nothing. I mean, what can you do? You sort of stay in your own area, and of course you can take security precautions in the house. You can do all that sort of thing. I'm married. I have a young family. I've got three young children. I'd like them to live as normal a life as possible. And I don't want them to be polluted by RUC threats, if it's at all avoidable.
But then this brings up, why do you take on these cases? Because, like you said, all your other fellow solicitors are now backing away after what happened to Pat Finucane, and they know the headaches that you get when you take on some of these cases. Why do you consistently do this?
I live in Lurgan. I'm local to the town. I live around the Lurgan Portadown area. I can't say to these people, I'll handle your personal injury claims. I'll handle your property transfers. But if you get into trouble, don't ask for me.
Rosemary Nelson, the late Rosemary Nelson, she's being buried today in her hometown. Violent protests in the Northern Ireland town and the killing of a former Protestant guerrilla overshadowed the St. Patrick's Day peace appeals yesterday by Irish and British politicians and by President Clinton. Violence erupted in the town of Portadown on the eve of Rosemary Nelson's funeral today. The human rights lawyer who was killed this week by a group tied to a pro-British paramilitary outfit. It's called the Red Hand Defenders. She was interviewed on Pacifica Station WBAI last April by Radio Free Erin, a weekly Irish show that includes John McDonough, Sandy Boyer, and Brian Moore. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the ruler. I'm Amy Goodman. University of Michigan students sat outside the school president's office demanding a meeting to discuss working conditions at factories that make university-licensed apparel. Members of Students Organizing for Labor and Economic Quality say they want to make sure the factories aren't operating under sweatshop conditions. President Lee Bollinger was not in his office yesterday. Students have spent the night in the building and resumed their protest today. The protests follow similar demonstrations at other campuses across the country. A key student demand is that manufacturers reveal the locations of the factories that make licensed apparel to make check on pay, safety, and workers' ages. The protests follow similar demonstrations at Wisconsin, Duke, Princeton, Yale, and other campuses. Organizers say they want to make sure that workers who make licensed apparel for universities have humane working conditions. Meanwhile, citing pressure from the student anti-sweatshop movement, 17 colleges and universities, including Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Duke, and Notre Dame, announced on Monday that they would be joining the Fair Labor Association, a group established by the White House that has formed a code of conduct for apparel factories and created a program to monitor violations. The move has angered many student activists who say the deal was reached behind their backs and that it does not go far enough to ensure fair labor practices, nor to eliminate sweatshop practices by the companies. We're joined right now by three students who are deeply involved in the issue around the country. Andy Cornell is with us, a junior at the University of Michigan, one of the protesters currently staging a sit-in at the office of the university's president. Eric Bracken joins us. He's a senior in sociology at the University of Wisconsin, was part of a delegation that met with the Labor Department on Tuesday. And we're joined by Nora Rosenberg. Nora Rosenberg is a sophomore majoring in Latin American Studies at Brown University in Rhode Island. Let's begin with Andy Cornell. Can you describe the scene at the University of Michigan right now, where you are?
Yes. Yesterday at about 9:30, 30 students here stormed into the office of the president of the university. It's a large office area that also has room for a number of assistants, little cubicles and such. And we've taken over that entire area and have made sure that the workers can't do their work. They tried yesterday, but our chants were too loud, and they basically locked up their important information and they left. This morning they tried to come into work again and were met with more chanting, and they promptly left again. So we're occupying the entire kind of interior area of President Bollinger's
and
office right now.
And tell us what your demands are, Andy.
Our demands are full public disclosure of the locations and names of factories where all apparel bearing the university name, logo, likeness, et cetera, are being made. We feel that's completely important if we're going to enforce any measures set forth in any code of conduct that universities sign. Beyond that, we want to ensure that workers are paid a living wage, that they can at least meet their basic human needs, such as food, clothing, shelter, with the wages that they're paid at these factories, which we know is not the case currently. And finally, we want to make sure that the University of Michigan does not follow the other 17 universities in signing onto the AIP-FLA code, which was mentioned briefly. That's the White House code, because we realize that's an incredibly weak code. It doesn't provide for the living wage or public disclosure or numerous other factors, and we see it as an attempt to co-opt the movement so that universities can say, yes, we are addressing these issues. We are against sweatshops, when in fact there are just completely inadequate enforcement mechanisms in that code.
Nora Rosenberg, Brown University, your school, is one of the universities that joined in that 17-university alliance with the White House. Can you explain what happened?
Basically, our president had committed to allowing students to be part of the entire process of code formation and implementation. And this Monday, we found out that he had signed on with the FLA. Our opinion of the FLA.
Fair Labor Association.
Right, the Fair Labor Association. Basically, the FLA is an organization that is suffering from a crisis of legitimacy, and they sought credibility from our universities since labor and corporate responsibility representatives have dropped off of that agreement.
Explain how it all happened. How it went from consulting with you to becoming a part of the White House Association.
I'm not exactly sure of the process. Our president told us that there was a phone conversation and he needed to decide at that moment, and he did, and that it's an effort to try to get our universities to work together. But we don't want our universities working together on an agreement that will cover up sweatshop conditions.
Eric Bracken, we have had you on the show actually just about a month ago with other students from around the country who were organizing these sit-ins, and you were very concerned at the time. In fact, were involved in a sit-in at the University of Wisconsin when we talked to you. Can you talk about this new alliance that includes Nike, Reebok, and Liz Claiborne that grew out of the White House apparel industry partnership, a group that had ended up splintering over how much companies should be made to reveal on their labor practices abroad?
Yeah, this was something that the Clinton administration started about 2 years ago in response to, you know, public pressure about sweatshop labor in the apparel industry. And there was a lot of controversy over the makeup of the committee, and they finally decided to kind of split it half and half between labor and human rights groups and then corporate corporations. And throughout the two-year negotiations, they remained deadlocked. But in November, without a number of key actors from the labor and human rights side aware of the new developments, the Apparel Industry Partnership, which is this White House task force, released an agreement right away, within days, some of the main actors, the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, Unite, which is a needle trades union, the AFL-CIO, and other unions, dropped off and said that they refused to support the document. And this leads up to what Nora characterized with where the AIP is now, I think correctly, as suffering from a crisis of legitimacy. And in order for them, to take this very weak code of conduct and this very weak monitoring mechanism and really legitimize it to the public, they have to get other, you know, big actors involved. And so that's where this latest push, we believe, to get universities to endorse the Apparel Industry Partnership and affiliate with their monitoring arm, the Fair Labor Association, which will monitor all these factories. That's where this latest push comes from, and I think that's why we saw the pronouncement on earlier this week. Unfortunately, like Nora said, this was done totally behind the backs of students at the universities, at these 17 universities. And the Secretary of Labor, Alexis Herman, in her press statement characterized this as a partnership between, you know, students and faculty and administrators and corporations. And in reality, that's, you know, just a completely ludicrous statement, and there is no partnership here. They just made the decision without us at the table.
So what do you plan to do now, Eric Bracken? And also, what happened at the University of Wisconsin? We spoke to you in the midst of the protest.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the University of Wisconsin, to give an update, we were 100% successful in pushing our university to support principles of full public disclosure of factory locations, initiate a global living wage study and commit to implementing the results of that study when they're known, and also including provisions about specific provisions for women's rights in the code of conduct. So we were 100% successful there. And as far as what we plan to do now, I mean, in some ways, the Apparel Industry Partnership and the Department of Labor have almost kind of dealt us the ace of spades in that, you know, we have had a code of conduct now, or we've had an agreement which we agree with, the administration, a satisfactory agreement for the past month. And now, there's a new push. In fact, there's one target now, and that is the Apparel Industry Partnership, which has already been attacked significantly by labor unions and by human rights organizations involved in the anti-sweatshop fight for being a completely weak document and being a cover-up for further exploitation. And so we intend to expose those holes because it is not acceptable for any more universities to sign on with the Fair Labor Association, either for monitoring purposes or to endorse their code of conduct.
We're talking to Eric Bracken, senior in sociology at the University of Wisconsin, part of the delegation that met with the Labor Department this past Tuesday. Also joining us from Rhode Island, Nora Rosenberg, sophomore majoring in Latin American Studies at Brown University and member of the Student Labor Alliance there. And on the phone with us, Andy Cornell, a junior at the University of Michigan, one of the protesters currently staging a sit-in at the office of the university's president. Andy Cornell, where do you see your protest going right now?
We are having significant media coverage. A lot of local labor leaders have been contacting us, requesting information on how they can contact the administration themselves. To put outside pressure and show support for us, the students, and for our demand. So we're hoping that kind of pressure, if it's kept up, will force the administration to capitulate. We're in high spirits. We're able to have food brought in by our outside supporters. Yesterday we had a rally of 100 people with very brief notice, and there'll be another one of those today. We did meet with administration officials, with the president of the university last night. A group of consider our bargaining team met with them for approximately an hour last night. Now, we didn't come out with an agreement there, but there is, I think, some sense of optimism that we are going to definitely push the university much further than they are willing to go on this issue. We're almost assured that we will receive full public disclosure at our university, stronger a stronger commitment and more explicit wording on women's rights that was also included at Wisconsin, the establishment of such as an advisory committee. And really right now we're just trying to work on this living wage issue. That seems to be what the university is holding up most about. They're digging their heels in. But we seem to be making some progress, so we're going to hold out a while longer. We've got plenty of food and supplies, and morale is high. I don't know if you can hear people in the background, but we've been meeting, having intense discussions on where we're going to go from here. Everyone's pretty excited, so I remain very optimistic, and I think we're going to come out of this with the strongest, or definitely one of the strongest statements yet from a university regarding the apparel industry and sweatshop. Mm.
Nora Rosenberg, can you explain how this series of protests from university to university caught on and really creating a kind of fire around the country?
Well, the first protest was at Duke University. The second was at Georgetown, and then there was one at Wisconsin. I think those three protests and what they want that came out of those protests, especially public disclosure, has helped us at Brown to win public disclosure here without needing to do more drastic action. I think it's an issue that many students feel a high stake in because we are protesting, we are working for the apparel that has our university name on it. And students feel that they have a stake in making sure that those items are made under safe working conditions and that workers are not disempowered, are not exploited for the sake of our universities with our name on it.
And we hear the protests in the background there at the University of Michigan.
Right. I'm guessing that some workers in the office just tried to enter into the occupied area, if you want to call it, or there's some significant media in the building. But we've been chanting and making noise sporadically when trying to save our energy when there's no one immediately around, but then being really loud and aggressive when we feel it will be beneficial and when it will really disrupt university business.
Well, Andy Cornell, I want to thank you for joining us from the University of Michigan, and Nora Rosenberg from Brown University. Eric Bracken, I'm going to give you the last word. As you met with the Labor Department on Tuesday, where you think the overall intercollegiate movement is going right now?
Well, I think you're going to see it step up. We saw within a couple of weeks protests in February at Duke, Georgetown, and Wisconsin. And I think the Michigan sit-in that's going on now is only the latest of probably another major step in protests that are going to be happening around the country.
When we last did this program, a lot of people called in to ask for a phone number. Where can people call to get connected to the college students who are protesting around the country against sweatshop labor?
You can tell them to give me a call in Wisconsin. We can get them to the right places. And that is at 608-265-4276.
That's 608-265-4276. Eric Bracken, thanks for being with us from the University of Wisconsin. And again, if you're just tuning in the background, protesters at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor currently staging a sit-in at the office of the university's president calling for an end to universities being connected to sweatshop labor. And that does it for this segment. When we come back, we're going to take a look at Latin America's largest economy, Brazil. We'll be looking at the Land Bank, the World Bank, and landless peasants. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Please stay with us.
Someone owns a the fruit. Someone owns the soil. Someone owns the water. And someone owns the oil. Someone owns the sky. Someone owns the trees. Someone owns my head. But they can't own me. Everyone's a criminal unless you got the money, honey. Everyone's a criminal now. Ooh, ooh, everyone's a criminal unless you got the money, honey. Everyone's a criminal now. Government is dead. Corporations rule. Politicians hoping that everyone's a fool. Wanna live in wish, don't wanna be a slave. Anything I gotta do to break that cage. Oh, everyone's a criminal unless you got the money, honey. Everyone's a criminal now. Ooh, ooh, everyone's a criminal unless you got the money, honey. Everyone's a criminal now.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Brazil is pledging to clamp down harder on its huge budget deficit in exchange for fresh cash from the International Monetary Fund to help heal the crisis-beaten economy. Today we're going to talk about Brazil, the International Monetary Fund, and also the World Bank, which is deeply involved in Brazil. We're joined by Rogério Succili, who coordinates the Brazilian Workers' Party's Agriculture Department. The Workers' Party is the largest opposition party in Brazil. Lula, its head, almost won the presidency several times. We're also joined by Maísa Mendonça, who is the head of the Brazil Project of Global Exchange, which is a human rights group based in San Francisco. She will translate for Rogério and also tell us about what Global Exchange is doing about Brazil and the international monetary institutions here in this country. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Rogério Succili, can you tell us about what is happening with the World Bank and Brazil?
Primeiramente, bom dia a todos os ouvintes. Eu queria falar sobre o Banco da Terra.
Good morning, and I'm here to speak about the Land Bank.
O Banco da Terra é um programa desenvolvido pelo governo brasileiro em convênio com o Banco Mundial.
By the Brazilian government in agreement with the World Bank.
Esse programa consiste num financiamento que o Banco Mundial e o governo brasileiro oferecem a todos os sem-terras.
The World Bank and the Brazilian government is making available a credit line to landless farmers in Brazil.
Interessados em adquirir seu lote de terra para trabalhar.
Who need a piece of land to work.
Os trabalhadores se organizam em cooperativas ou individualmente e buscam crédito junto ao Banco da Terra.
The way it works is that the farmers can organize in a group or individually and borrow money from the World Bank.
E terão um prazo de liquidação desse crédito em 10 anos com taxa de juros de 12% ao ano.
And they can pay back within a period of 10 years and the interest rates is about 12%.
Esse banco terá um montante em dinheiro de 2 bilhões de dólares, sendo que 1 bilhão por parte do governo brasileiro e 1 bilhão do Banco Mundial.
The total amount for this project is $2 billion, $1 billion coming from the Brazilian government and $1 billion from the World Bank.
Mas por que para nós este programa é um programa problemático, um programa que nos preocupa?
But why are we concerned about this project?
Primeiro porque o Estado, o governo brasileiro, se omite de conduzir todo o processo de reforma agrária.
Because that takes out the responsibility from the Brazilian government to implement real agrarian reform in Brazil.
E um processo de reforma agrária para ter efetiva, ter consequências reais e dar resultado, ele precisa ser conduzido pelo Estado, ser coordenado pelo governo.
And we believe that in order to achieve good results in a project like that, the state needs to be involved and responsible for the process.
Em segundo lugar, pelo atual projeto do governo, garantido pela Constituição, as propriedades são desapropriadas, que são desapropriadas para a reforma agrária, são aquelas que não cumprem sua função social, isto é, são aquelas que não respeitam a lei.
So, right now, according to the Brazilian Constitution, land that are not fulfilling its social function can be expropriated for agrarian reform.
E o que é não respeitar a função social, a lei brasileira? É não produzir nada na sua terra, não respeitar os direitos trabalhistas, não respeitar o meio ambiente, ter trabalho escravo, plantio de psicotrópicos.
So, and what does it mean that these people are not following the Constitution is because they are not producing at a certain level in their land, they don't respect the environment, or they don't respect labor rights.
Esses proprietários que têm essas terras que não cumprem a função social serão desapropriadas e eles receberão em títulos da dívida agrária resgatável em 20 anos.
So, according to the Constitution, these lands can be expropriated, and the owners receive payment back, but in forms of bonds, and they get paid within a period of 20 years.
Isto é uma forma de punição para quem não respeita a lei e a Constituição brasileira.
So this is a form of punishment for the ones who don't respect the law.
Com o Banco da Terra, esses latifundiários, esses fazendeiros serão premiados porque receberão em dinheiro vivo, in cash.
So, according to the World Bank project, these landowners are going to receive upfront in cash for their land.
Em segundo lugar, porque com tanto dinheiro no mercado, provavelmente vai haver uma valorização do preço da terra, do valor da terra.
Also, if you put so much money in the market for people to buy land, the price of the land is going to be inflated.
Em terceiro lugar, e o que é muito importante e sério, é que se atualmente, pela crise da agricultura brasileira, os trabalhadores rurais não conseguem vingar seus créditos com juros de 6%, imagine vocês com 12% ao ano, que é o proposto pelo Banco da Terra.
Also, if small farmers today cannot pay back their loans at 6% interest rates, imagine if they would be able to pay back at 12% interest rates.
Também o Estado não conduzindo o processo de reforma agrária, de que forma os pequenos proprietários ou sem terras terão condições de avaliar a qualidade da terra, se ela tem condições para o plantio, se ela é floresta que não pode ser derrubada, elas não terão condições nenhuma, será um desastre.
So, also, if there is no technical support, how these landless farmers will know what type of land they are buying? They could be buying forest, they could be buying land that is not good for agriculture.
E também os trabalhadores jamais foram escutados ou perguntados sobre o interesse e que programa seria interessante para eles. Foi um pacote, uma proposta que desceu do Banco Mundial, uma receita do FMI e em acordo com o governo brasileiro.
So also none of the farm workers organizations have been consulted about this project. That was an agreement made directly between the World Bank and the Brazilian government.
Então, teríamos tantos outros motivos e críticas ao Banco da Terra, mas esse já ilustra mais ou menos por que nos preocupa tanto. Então, quais são os verdadeiros motivos de implantarem este programa do Banco Mundial e o governo brasileiro?
So there are other problems with the project, but just to illustrate, I gave you some examples. But what is behind this agreement?
Realmente, o governo brasileiro está precisando e está querendo aprofundar as reformas impostas pelo FMI no Brasil.
So, the Brazilian government is following all the IMF policies and is implementing those in Brazil.
Eles estão preparando, o governo Fernando Henrique Cardoso, com o apoio e assessoria do FMI, o programa Plano Real número 2.
So the Cardoso's government, in accord with the IMF, is now trying to implement the second phase of its economic plan.
Isto é, estamos entrando numa nova fase de um projeto estratégico muito ambicioso.
So there is a whole strategy behind this.
E que, no nosso entendimento, terá três medidas drásticas para o Brasil, especialmente para os pobres do Brasil.
So we think that that agreement will have three particular consequences, especially for poor people in Brazil.
E todos eles nos levam a uma desnacionalização e a uma perda de soberania.
So, and the consequence of those will be the lack, the inability of for people in Brazil to make decisions about their nation.
Quais são essas três medidas drásticas?
So what are these three points?
A primeira delas é a dolarização da moeda. controlada por um conselho da moeda já muito discutido e muito experimentado em todo o mundo.
So the first one is the dollarization of the Brazilian economy and the control of its currency being made by the US Central Bank.
A segunda dela é aprofundar as privatizações. No Brasil, faltam apenas o Banco do Brasil, a Caixa Econômica Federal e a Petrobras, três estatais da maior importância para o Brasil e para a população brasileira.
So, the second one is to finish the process of privatizations. Right now, the only sectors that have not been privatized are the oil sectors and the national banks.
E em terceiro lugar, o governo brasileiro está buscando minar a relação do Brasil no Mercosul, isto é, ele vai tentar aprofundar e se aproximar cada vez mais da ALCA.
So also the Brazilian government is not interested anymore in supporting the free trade agreement within the southern hemisphere countries, the Mercosul. Instead, it's going to probably join the free trade agreement of the Americas.
Todas estas medidas levam a uma desnacionalização e uma perda de soberania.
So all those measures would have as a consequence difficulties for us to become a sovereign nation.
Mas o que tudo isso tem a ver com o Banco da Terra?
So, but why is this related to the land bank?
É que para implantar tal programa, o governo brasileiro precisa destruir todas as resistências ao aprofundamento do seu modelo econômico neoliberal.
Because the government needs to destroy all forms of resistance to this project.
E no Brasil, um dos pontos mais fortes de resistência ao atual modelo se encontra nas lutas populares do campo.
And the greatest points of resistance in Brazil to this project are coming from the part of rural workers' organizations.
E, em particular, o movimento do Sem Terra.
And in particular, the landless workers' movement.
E implantando um programa Banco da Terra, o governo brasileiro busca destruir o MST e a luta pela reforma agrária no Brasil.
So, by implementing this project with the World Bank, the government wants to destroy the struggle for land reform in Brazil.
Porque provavelmente alguns trabalhadores que estão há muito tempo na miséria, desesperados, tenderão a aceitar a proposta sem saber que em 2 anos terão que abandonar porque não terão menor condições de viabilizar o seu projeto e o seu assentamento.
Because that's going to divide the movement, because some landless workers would end up borrowing money from the World Bank and probably end up losing their land in a couple of years.
E então, para o governo e para o FMI, a reforma agrária não interessa. É apenas uma forma de tentar desmobilizar as organizações populares do campo.
So the IMF and the World Bank are not really interested in implementing agrarian reform in Brazil. What they want is to destroy the rural workers' organizations.
And you're listening to Rogério Sicilli, who is the coordinator of the Brazilian Workers' Party's agriculture department, the Brazilian Workers' Party being the largest opposition party in Brazil. And he's been translated by Maísa Mendoza, who is coordinator of the Brazil program at Global Exchange, a human rights group based in San Francisco. Actually, I wanted to ask you, Maísa, about what you're doing here in the United States to organize around the whole issue of the World Bank and the IMF in Brazil.
We have been on a speaking tour and meeting basically with several organizations in the U.S., in Washington, D.C., New York, Boston, and San Francisco to create a network to support the landless workers movement in Brazil and to fight against the World Bank project.
How are you doing?
Well, basically, we have received information from Brazil that the movement is prioritizing 3 forms of resistance. One is that they're going to organize mass protests in Brazil throughout the month of April. And April 17th is the International Day Against Violence in the Countryside, and there will be mass protests in Brazil. Also, several rural workers' organizations have asked the inspection panel of the World Bank to investigate this project. And the inspection panel is supposed to make a decision and ask the board of the World Bank to approve this investigation by the beginning of April. So we are going to organize a delegation who is going to come to Washington, D.C. and meet with World Bank representatives at that point. And at the same time, we are organizing a letter campaign at Global Exchange website. If you check our website, you can fax a letter to the World Bank directly. And we're also going to start mobilizing some Congress members here in the U.S.
And why do you see this as critical for people to get involved with in the United States?
Brazil is the largest economy in Latin America, and its economy is pretty much controlled now by the U.S. and the multinational financial institutions. And the lives of Brazilians right now depend a lot on the kind of organizing that people can do here in the U.S. And I think even the progressive community here knows very little about Brazil and also its very vibrant social movements.
If this is the most popular stance in Brazil, why is it that Lula keeps losing presidential elections?
Well, I think you have to understand that the Workers' Party is fighting against very powerful forces. First of all, it's fighting a government that is being supported by multinational financial institutions, by all the commercial media in Brazil, big business. And Lula had 30% of the votes without having any support from businesses. So the Workers' Party is very much connected to popular movements, and that's why it's being so successful. Although Lula is not able to win the presidency, Lula wasn't able to win the presidency, the Workers' Party has continuously increasing their number of governors, state governors, mayors, Congress members. So it has a very large representation at other levels of the government.
So again, what people can do here?
First of all, people can check the Global Exchange website, and that is www.globalexchange.org, and learn more about the World Bank project and send letters to the World Bank. And we also are urging people to contact Congress members from their areas and try to educate them about what's happening in Brazil, and also just trying to get the word out, because I think that even the progressive media is missing the story.
Maísa Mendonça, I want to thank you for being with us, head of the Brazil program at the San Francisco-based Global Exchange, the human rights group in the Bay Area. Also, thank you to Rogério Sicilli, who is head of the Agriculture Department of the Workers' Party, the largest opposition party in Brazil. If you'd like to order a cassette of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
So the waters of March, it's the end of a string, it's the joy in your